All right, podcast folks, welcome to this week's rerun edition, encore edition. This one was suggested by a listener. It is one of my most popular interviews, and notorious is sort of the right word to use here because the guest is very close to going off the rails. He says some really weird things, had to be bleeped at one point. It's the great Emmett Rose, just an amazingly talented guy, interesting guy. Just a strange career, started when he was so young, obviously so full of talent, and then, you know, it just didn't work mentally. I don't know. In this interview, it's 5 years old, and he talks about he's working on a new record, should be out, I think he says, within a year or so, and that record's still not out, although there is on the internet some evidence of him playing out in public appearances more, and some evidence of him working on the record. There's pictures and videos and stuff, but still no record. But I'll bet there will be something, some new recordings from Emmett Rose soon. Super talented guy. He also does something in this interview which I always love, which is he actually picks up a guitar and demonstrates something, even though he's talking on the phone. So this was obviously taped ahead of time. I called him one Saturday afternoon. He doesn't pick up the phone, and slowly he eventually picks up the phone and he gets into it. And it's an amazing story and a really interesting, talented guy. And I hope you enjoy this one. If you've got a suggestion for somebody who want me to encore an older podcast, drop me an email, michaels@wfmu.org. This one is really, at some points, tough to listen to almost, but super interesting story. I hope you enjoy this and listen to some Emmett Rose music because the music is just fantastic. That's something everybody agrees with. Okay, here it is, Emmett Rose.
Hello. Please leave a message after the tone.
Hey, it's Michael Shaley from WFMU for Emmett Rose. I will try back in a couple minutes, I guess.
Hello?
Emmett, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
This is Michael, right?
That's right.
I'm waking up.
That's what I'm doing.
Well, I appreciate you waking up early for us this morning.
Well, it's not that early.
Yeah. I've got.
But it is, does require waking up, so there you go.
That's always a good first step for a day. Well, let's start at the beginning. Born in 1950, Decatur, Illinois, right? Sort of in the meat of the baby boom, and your family moved to, I think, Hawthorne, California?
I think I am the baby boom.
You were five when you moved to Hawthorne. Do you remember sort of a culture shock from...
I remember kind of, you know, in the car, let me see, Eisenhower was president. I remember the radio was on. And
So you moved to California. It's 1955. What are your first impressions of music? What's in your house? What are your parents listening to?
Well, you know, my mother ran around singing. You know, the reason I'm a songwriter is my mother's fault. I blame her.
Well, that's good. What, she was a musical person in a serious way or just in a very casual way?
Well, at home it was in a casual way. But when she was younger, she went out and performed with her mother and stepfather.
And so what did your folks do in Hawthorne? What was the family business?
Well, there wasn't really a business. My father was a welder. He worked for the aerospace for a while. Mm-hmm. But when he died, he was a welder. And my mother, was a stay-at-home mom.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I have half-sisters, and that's about what I got.
Okay. And so growing up, at what point did you take music lessons, or how did that work?
I took drum lessons.
So when you were a little kid in grade
that
school?
It was grade school. I learned how to beat on a bench.
And so you were playing in the band concerts?
No, I played my snare drum the parent-teacher, whatever they do in grade school when they get people up on stage, and I played my snare drum. It was really loud, so people knew when I started. and they knew when I stopped. So they knew when to applaud.
And by the time you're in high school, you're already in bands. When did you join your first band? When did that happen?
Well, I kind of made my first band is what I did. I had a friend who didn't know how to play, and I knew how to play drums, but wasn't much of a guitar player, and we kind of learned how to play guitar together and sing Beatles songs.
Yeah, I guess that was the thing to do right around there.
Well, it certainly seemed like it.
Yeah. You're also a contemporary of the Beach Boys. They were in Hawthorne. There must be some that are exactly your age, or would have been.
No, they were all older than me.
Were they all older?
I went to Dennis, was the drummer. He was like a senior when I was a freshman. That
okay.
kind of thing.
That makes sense. So you didn't really cross too many paths with the Beach Boys.
I ran into them at the high school dance, and it broke my drum pedal or my drum head or something like that. I loaned him my drums for.
So you guys shared a drum kit once and they broke
it? Well, he shared my drum kit and he broke it.
That's pretty funny. Well, he was kind of like...
I don't know if it's that funny. I wasn't at the time.
When you were 15, yeah. He did play in that sort of very King Kong way, Dennis.
He was a horrid drummer. I mean, he just hit... I mean, he played backwards and he was a horrid drummer.
Yeah. Interesting guy, certainly.
Well, he was a kind of a wild guy from what I understand. I didn't really know him that well, but he was a... But he played backwards. I thought that was odd.
I mean, he was a lefty who was playing righty?
It was kind of... I don't really recall now. I mean, I remember that he had to move the whole set around and he hit the hi-hat on the other side or something. I mean, it was... he had his unique way of playing.
Yeah. So you're in a band...
Don't expect me to say anything good about him.
Please don't.
he owes me a drum pedal.
Yeah, but good luck collecting on that. Yeah,
it ain't going to happen.
Your band is called the Emeralds, and you're 15 or so at this time, and you turn into a band called the Palace Guard, right?
Yeah, and I'm a drummer.
And you're still the drummer at this point.
I'm a drummer.
Were you already thinking at age 15, I'm going to be a musician for life, or were you thinking I'll be a doctor or something, and this is just to get girls?
I wish I had thought I'd be a research scientist. But no, I liked music.
You were already. And were your folks okay with that? Did people think that was crazy?
Well, my mother understood it better than she did physics. Or did physics, so...
Sure, it was in the blood, sort of.
Yeah, whatever. It was. I don't know. I think I was fulfilling her desires.
There's a song called Falling Sugar, 1966, and it's on one of the Nuggets compilations, so it's sort of...
Yeah.
It's out there. It's kind of a very...
I think it's a gay record, but I'm not real sure.
A gay record? A homosexual record?
Well, you never know.
No, you never know. I mean, tell me about, like...
No, there's something weird about that song. It was never one of my favorites.
Okay.
But it was that and All Night Long, there was a couple of songs that the Palace Guard did that we always did.
I mean, it was in the mid-60s, and, in the wake of the Beatles, I think record companies were finally, in America, waking up and thinking, hey, this rock and roll thing might be around for a while. I think when Elvis came, there was some of the biggest record companies in the world still wouldn't take on a rock and roll band. They were afraid it was some sort of a fad, or they would offend,
Well, that's just business in general. Who wants to invest in gold, it might go down.
Yeah. So how did that early band at 15? How did you guys sort of get into the recording business and start doing recordings?
Oh, well, the Beaudoin brothers had a father who.
There were three brothers in this band.
There were three brothers, and it was like a family band, and I was the drummer, there was. Well, they got a company called Orange Empire to sponsor them and to produce these records that they did. And boy, it's a horrid story. I think the Beaudoins gave their youngest son to a gay man who owned the company. It was pedophilia. I should have said something, but I was like 14, and he was 14, I feel horrid now.
You mean really the one of the brothers had to sleep with somebody to get the record deal?
Pretty much.
Wow.
That's you know, it's a real life sucks, buddy. Yeah. It really does.
Well,
the truth of the matter. You know, people do things for. I think it's all hormonal. I think you know we're just a bunch of insane animals, and we're going through life trying to gratify ourselves.
Well, I'm not sure life sucks, but the music business.
Okay.
You know.
Maybe you're less depressed than me.
Yeah. My life's pretty good right at the
there
moment.
There you go. When it's good, go for it, buddy.
So you're in this band, The Palace Guard. You also did some songs backing or with Don Grady, one of the actors on My Three Sons.
Right, yeah. He was a nice guy.
He seemed like a nice guy, and he's still doing music to this day.
I ran across him. He gave me a copy of a CD of something that he was doing, yeah.
All right. And you guys were on TV and stuff like that. You end up getting a job as the house band at a pretty hot Hollywood club called the Hullabaloo. You're still the drummer at this point. House band means how many nights, how many hours?
Oh, God. All during the week. And I worked all week.
Five or six nights a week, you'd play for how many hours?
Then. Oh, well, it was two or three shows a night, depending on what night it was, I guess.
And playing covers of the day, were you throwing some originals in there?
Well, the Beaudoins had a song called All Night Long. I was still a drummer at that time. I was just learning how to play guitar.
And, I mean, it's sort of...
Or shortly did thereafter.
It seems like a sort of a great education to be the house band and to sort of, you know, make your mistakes, or get your chops up. Was it a...
Well, I was a drummer. Nobody knows when you fuck up. So, you just hit things. So, you know, that's what a drummer does. They just hit stuff.
Yeah. So being the house band, that wasn't a step in the progression of Emmett Rhodes?
Oh, it was great. It was great. There I was. I was in Hollywood. It was a great club. And the stage revolved. And, one band was rolled off, a new band was rolled on or spun on.
And were there touring headliners coming through there at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Everybody came through there.
Like, who'd you get to see?
Everybody.
Like the Rolling Stones?
The Stones didn't do that. But there was Loving Spoonful, Ike and Tina Turner, and, you know, when there wasn't Ike and Tina Turner, and, you know.
That sounds fantastic for a music fan as
Cher
well.
Cher and Sonny, and, you know, it was everybody, the Birds, it was Buffalo Springs, it was everybody, yeah. Everybody, except, you know, the Beatles didn't do it because they were too rich, and, I guess the Stones wasn't big enough for the Stones.
It sort of sounds like the center of the universe in some ways.
In Hollywood, it pretty much was at the time, I think.
Yeah. So you end up realizing, boy, being back here behind the drums sucks. I should be out in front.
I started writing songs. That's what I started doing. It's being behind. Drumming is, you can do, you know, you just hit things.
So you taught
all the guys up front got the, you know, all the attention.
You taught yourself to play the guitar and shortly after writing songs?
Well, I just started writing songs. I didn't know how to play the guitar. I didn't know how to tune the guitar. Very first song I wrote to the guitar, you know, I mean, it's just kind of like, it was kind of in tune, except I'd have no idea how it was tuned.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, I just started strumming. It sounded good, so I wrote something on top of that, because I can do that. I can just come out with a melody or a...
Well, when you say that now, and you seem pretty nonchalant about it, but when you first did it, you were still a teenager. I mean, that first time the guitar wasn't in tune, was it a revelation to you? Hey, I can write these songs,
it
too.
It was fun. It was just fun. I just enjoyed it.
Yeah. And how long to write a song in those very early days?
Well, it's instantaneous.
So a three-minute song?
Yeah, no. It's after a while, I got serious. So then, of course, you know, you have to think about the chords and all that kind of stuff. You want to make sure that what you're saying is pertinent to what your chorus is. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of things. You count syllables and all that stuff.
So you quit the Palace Guard and you form the merry-go-round. You switch from the drums to the guitar. I believe.
And then I got to come out front.
You got to come out front and be the
and start singing all the time, because I sang one song in the in the palace guard.
They'd give you a spot like the...
They let me come out front. It was a hullabaloo, and it had like a runway, and
yeah.
You get to walk out on the runway, and it was like nonsense, complete nonsense.
I always like when they give this, when the drummer gets to come down and sing one. I always find
there
that.
There you go. And I got to sing Michelle, wonderful song.
Oh, so you sang that every night for a couple of years?
Well, I'm not certain that they let me do it every night.
Well, that's pretty funny. You probably never want to hear that song again.
No. It's still a wonderful song.
Yeah. So the,
I don't want to sing it, but...
the membership of the merry-go-round changes around. Finally, it cements Joel Larson, who ends up being in a bunch of great bands. And I think he's playing with you even today.
Yeah, right. I'm written some songs and in the process of recording them.
Yeah.
And Joe's helping out.
I want to get to that. So it's 1967, I think, when the merry-go-round comes together. You're still 17, 18 years old at this point, and you just start making some demos. Well,
we rehearsed a lot. I had a bunch of songs, and then we went into the studio for A&M, and we recorded of a record, the whole album.
And how?
It was basically, you know, one or two passes, and we picked the best pass and then sang the vocals over the top of it, and that was that.
How did the hookup come with A&M, not Eminem?
Well, it was the son of who became of the, another family, the Shaw family, and he was a gay, and you know, he wanted to butt fuck me, and but I didn't know that. I was, like, so young and naive, and I, what can I tell you, I don't know that stuff. And I just kind of believe people. They tell me, you know, like, you're a radio personality. Okay, I don't know. You called me out of nowhere. I don't know who you are. Nonetheless, anyway, I believe people. And whatever. It was, it's a horror story. What do you want? It's a horror story.
So this guy,
I'm so naive. I don't know what's going on until way later in life.
So you're a 17-year-old, and you've got this.
I liked girls. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was a hard thing. But
so you've got this manager.
It's real popular now, but you know, back then, people were kind of ashamed of being gay.
But there were a lot of homosexuals in the music business, and one of them was
your
manager.
I think there's just a lot of homosexuals, don't you?
Yeah, there's about 10%. I think
football's homosexual. I think a bunch of guys running around in these here, you know, spandex things and jumping on one another, slapping each other on the bottom. And, you know, there's something weird about it to me.
I'm not a fan.
I'm not either. I'm like not a sports person. I'm like a science person. I like cosmology.
What mology?
Cosmology.
Oh, the cosmos.
The cosmos, that's it.
There you go. So this guy somehow becomes your manager and gets you...
Well, he does. He's working for Russell Shaw. He's working for A&M. He's working in the mailroom, so he knows everybody. And he becomes kind of like our manager.
Now, let's discuss the sound of the merry-go-round. It's 1967, and it sort of incorporates... There's so much good music. I mean, it's an explosion of good music in the UK, in Hollywood, in the United States. And this is like, you know...
People are writing songs.
Yeah, these are great songs, really melodic, but, you know, kind of... It's just a... It seems to be perfectly in time with what's happening, the merry-go-round, you know?
It could be, because I was there. I'm not dead yet. I may not be in time with what's going on. I don't own a cell phone.
Yeah, me neither.
And I probably never will. But maybe I'll do, you know, like I'll get one that you've prepaid or something that nobody can call me on. Just in case I need one, because I've seen that.
I don't have one either, Emmett, and I hope,
there you go.
Hope I never get one.
Well, when I was a little boy riding around Hawthorne in my on my bicycle, I was in this liquor store, and there was this woman out front walking down the street talking into her hand.
She was ahead of the curve, I guess.
Well, boy, was she. She was schizophrenic. Now everybody is.
She was ahead of the curve on schizophrenia.
Yep.
So when you
yep.
were you made those early records, those merry-go-round records for A&M, did you sit in the studio listening to them and think, this is good. This is something good. This is something that stacks up against my favorite records.
No, I just kept hoping it was good enough. The things I do now, I think, are good.
So,
because I know better. Back then, I was just guessing.
Were you unsatisfied with them, or you just didn't know?
I'm always unsatisfied.
Yeah.
It's you keep doing it until you give up.
The song "Live" and the song "You're a Very Lovely Woman" were both, pretty good hits, and certainly turntable hits in certain parts of the country, and. Those records are, I think they're all still, they're all out available. There's a merry-go-round.
Well, they've been reissued a number of times.
Yeah, a number of times. And they're great records. I've often thought that if the merry-go-round had stayed together and had a chance to sort of hone its thing a little bit more, it would have made a lot of hit records.
High school bands are like, people are, you have to deal with people.
Yeah.
It's scary. We're insane animals, and, every once in a while the insanity just pops right out.
Oh, don't you think, though, it doesn't help that you were 16 or 17 at that time? You were still a kid.
Oh, yeah. I was completely naive.
I mean, do you ever look back?
It helps, believe me.
Do you ever look back and say, I wish me and the members of the merry-go-round could have kept kept it together on a personal level?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So
after that, I bought a tape machine and I went into, the shed behind my parents' garage and I made a record on my own.
Yeah.
And I had even more fun.
You did. I guess you don't have to vote on let the drummer have a vote,
Well, I am the drummer. There you go. And it's like, when I try to outdo myself, it's like the guitar player always plays more than everybody else, and everybody's trying to outdo each other. Well, it's like when you're doing everything, you can't do that.
Yeah. So the merry-go-round's over, and you, like you said, you bought some equipment, went into the shed behind your parents' house, and just started to make some records. I think first you had to make a record which ended up being called The American Dream to fulfill the merry-go-round contract for A&M.
Right.
So you deliver that to A&M, and they say, we're just going to put this on the shelf. And then you start another record, which ends up becoming the Emmett Rhodes record, your first solo album, and comes out on ABC Dunhill, right?
Yeah.
Now, let's talk recording contract. It's just such a big part of your legacy. What happened?
I was sold. I was like property, and I was sold. I was told what to do. Russell Shaw's father, Eddie Shaw, was my publisher at the time, and he told me to sign the deal, and I signed the deal, and I knew it was wrong because it took me 9 months to make the record I had done to get the deal, and they wanted me to make a record every 6 months.
Yeah, that was a clause in the contract was Emmett
Rhodes. I looked at him and I said, Eddie, this is bad. This is wrong. I can't do this. I can't fulfill. And he says, sign it. We'll worry about it later.
And was that a normal thing to make a record every 6 months?
Well, for Eddie, it was.
I guess
he worked for like Sinatra, and Sinatra went out and got had people looking for songs,
yeah.
and he just sang them. And so
I guess
on.
Bands like Gary Lewis and the Playboys, they could easily churn out a record of covers, recorded in a couple of days, maybe is that what they were thinking? You were gonna.
Well, I was like doing it all myself, and it takes quite a while because sometimes you do it and then you don't like it and you have to do it again.
Yeah. So when you're making, for instance, your first record, did you work on it every single day, or how did it? What was the process?
Oh yeah, I'm pretty I get consumed.
Hmm. Sort of like an addiction?
Well, I suppose, I think everything's an addiction. I like life, too, I'm addicted to it.
Hmm. During this time, it's the late 60s, were there drugs involved in your regime?
Well, I am drugs. I'm just like walking drugs. I'm a 60 trillion, I think it's 100 trillion living cells. And they're all just made of chemicals.
Yeah. So you're,
and that's me. There you go.
Your body is a pharmaceutical
Well, it's
lab.
Pretty much that. So, yeah, was there drugs? Yeah, there was drugs everywhere.
And
it still is. It's like, what kind of,
And was that a big...
I think those Egyptians were doing it long back, in the pharaohs.
Yes, as soon as there was...
And I think, the Romans were just like a bunch of drug addicts.
I'm sure we'll find in, you know, somewhere in Africa, a bong made of, you know,
there you go.
Stone or something.
Now, I don't know how people got to that, you know, like, well, let's snort this here, let's snort this leaf. Or, I mean, I guess it was chewing it, I suppose. That's how I got there. But
there were early adapters, and some died, and the ones who didn't.
That's it. Yeah. There you go. Now, this is how you do it. Okay.
Yeah,
everybody follow suit.
Follow the guy who didn't die.
Yeah, but what was it, that Depravol stuff that Michael Jackson does? I heard that was good.
But that couldn't have been a surprise to you when Michael Jackson died. I mean,
no, I was glad he died. He looked like a woman.
So were drugs a big part of your life or not really? Just
oh, well, I suppose. I'm a diabetic now. I take insulin. It's the magic elixir. Keeps me alive.
Ah, how long have you been diabetic?
Oh, for quite a while.
Yeah, that's no fun. Yeah, and you have to inject that?
It's I inject.
Ugh, that's no fun at all. So you made this first record, and it's,
yeah, I don't like needles.
Me neither. I'm like my daughter. I cry.
Yeah, me too.
So you made this first record, and it's a record with a lot of staying power. It's been reissued in many ways all over the world a million times. It's one of those records that musicians like. It's also a record that did pretty well at the time, that was reviewed well at the time, and is always mentioned in lists of, you know, best records of the 70s, best records of all time. It's a really interesting record. Was it something that you said, I'm going to make a record that sounds a certain way, or it just came out organically?
I did the best I could.
Yeah.
That
was the plan? Do the
that
best?
That's always the plan. You got a better one?
Well, some people... No, I don't. But some people's plan is try to make money or try to copy something.
I wish I tried to make money. Like I said, I would have invested in gold.
Mm. So you put out this record.
Either that or become a counterfeiter and get myself a good printing machine.
Let me know how that works out.
Yeah, right.
You make it the next record, Mirror, 1971, and it's pretty much the same thing. You're in your parents' shack there, recording, and right around that time, A&M decides, this guy's doing all right. We'll release what we've got, which is that American Dream record, right?
Right.
And then you make in 73, Farewell to Paradise, your last solo record, and then the lawsuits hit the fan, right?
Well, that was kind of to get rid of the lawsuit, but I was 6 months after I made after I had signed my deal with ABC, the contract was suspended, and or I was in suspension or something, whatever, you know, and then they started suing me.
Why do you think they didn't just say, okay, we can wait 9 months or let's compromise? I mean, why? That seems like that must
happen. Well, because they wanted to make me feel bad.
Is that true? I mean,
how do I know?
Well,
none of it made any sense to me.
Yeah,
it was like, okay, I make a record in 6 months, and well, when do I go and perform? When do I, you know, celebrate my birthday and Christmas and the holiday? You know, when do I take a vacation?
Yeah.
None of it made any sense.
But you don't have any...
I looked at Eddie and I said, Eddie, I shouldn't sign this. And Eddie said, sign it. We'll worry about it later. Because Eddie was getting paid off.
But you don't have an inkling why they didn't want to work with you later down the road?
Well, because, God, what was it? It was Jay Lasker was not the easiest person in the world to get along with.
Hmm. Do you think there was...
And he kind of like, you know, if you didn't do what he wanted, he didn't like you anymore.
Ah. So you... Jay Lasker was the guy running ABC Dunhill?
He was at the time, yeah.
Yeah. So you got...
I don't know if there's a lot of people that have a lot of nice things to say about him other than maybe his daughter.
Mm. So you got on his bad side and he was sort of trying to punish you?
Well, it's the real life. Real life is weird. You know, people are strange. They just lost interest, I suppose. You know, I have, you punish me. It was punishment, but if that was their consideration or not, I'm not so certain. I think it's just because I signed a bad. It was a bad deal, and I fell apart during it. I wore out. I just wore out.
So, 1973, you're 23 years old, and it's over. You're
and I'm
washed
worn
up.
Out. I spend every day writing songs, every day making. You know, it, yeah. You know what I'm saying.
All right, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, after a while, you want to go have fun.
Tell me for a minute about Kurt Betcher worked on Farewell to Paradise. His name's on a lot of great records. What was
well,
your...
he's gay, wasn't he?
I don't know. I never slept with
him. Yeah, I think he was. Yeah. You know, for me, I just, you know, kind of, I just shine it on and look the other way. But
I mean, tell me about your working with him. I mean, were you in the room with him, or did he...
No, Kurt was a friend of Keith's, and...
So he took the tapes.
I mean, we just got together and smoked a lot of dope.
I see. And he took the tapes, mixed them, and were you happy with...
No, it wasn't him at all. It was actually Keith Olsen.
Oh,
Keith
really?
Olsen is brilliant. I learned a lot about engineering from Keith.
Interesting. So Kurt's contributions really aren't...
Wasn't very much. Well, he brought the drugs.
Oh, well, that's important. someone's got to bring the drugs.
Gave him something to do.
You get a mixing credit for that, I guess. So Dunhill sues you, and it's all a giant, you know, it's just awful, and... You sort of just retreat into yourself, I guess. Was it an active lawsuit? I mean, did you have to appear in court? Was it something that got drawn out?
No, as soon as I gave them no record, it was, you know, that was it. It was done.
That was it. And did you think, I'll wait a couple of years, I'll bounce back? Or did you, what were you thinking in your head?
Oh, I was, by that time, you know, I'm just totally insane now and don't know what the hell to do. It's like I had worked real hard and done my best and been punished.
Yeah.
So what do you do after that?
So just
I didn't really feel good about writing anymore. I kind of like I didn't want Eddie to have anything to do with what I had my songs and I had signed an agreement with him for life, for perpetuity. And I pretty much Eddie considered me his property.
So Eddie Shaw, this is Russell's dad, the mailroom.
This is Russell's dad,
the mailroom guy's dad.
Yeah, and they're both dead now. I had to get rid of you know Eddie's the oldest son who was selling clothes at the time that I was making records because I was like given to you know I was like property that was. An inheritance.
So you signed this...
And he was, like, taking my money. And there you go. So they were just all taking my money.
So are songs that you write today still published by the Shaws?
No. Now they're mine. I own them.
You got out of...
Except for Eddie sold some of my publishing to Universal, and they still claim it.
So even in those days, those first... Those four solo records and the Marigold records, do you still own half your publishing? Is that the way it works? Or no, you earn nothing.
Well, you know, I got paid whenever. Well, Eddie would like put me on his salary is what he you know he gave me money a month and then and everything I did he owned. That was pretty much how it was.
Wow, and so
he got to do whatever he wanted to do because he would just bring something down, put it in front of me, and say sign it, and I did.
So you never got to see the checks that were coming in.
No, of course not.
Yeah. So tell me, what did you do from, you know, 1973 for the next few years? What did you do every day?
Well, let me see. I ate and I... That's what people do.
Yeah.
I showered, probably.
Was when not playing music, did that blow your mind?
What did I do?
You know, but because...
Yeah, I could have read a book in that period of time. I watched TV.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things to do.
That's very American. I mean, it occurs to me that, you know, you spent the past 10 years
writing songs
every day.
No, I'd come up with ideas and stuff, and I'd put them down on tape and just leave them alone. I never got back to them. But now I'm actually finishing things. I'm going to make a record.
The legend has it that there are boxes and boxes of these old tapes that you made.
No, there isn't. There are old songs that didn't complete. You know, some of which I've completed. You know, now they're finished songs that I haven't recorded yet.
Gotcha.
But there isn't a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I have a lot of song ideas, you know, that
but I haven't completed them. It's time for me to complete stuff before I drop dead.
Yeah. From 1976 to 1980, I think you worked for Elektra Records. Who hired you there, and what were their expectations of you?
Chuck Plotkin, and he just, I have no idea what his expectation was. It was, I needed employment, and it was a good job. I got to hang out, and I played or engineer and like operated a studio for them that they had out in the valley, and then I became producer and made a record for them, and that was it.
It's a weird time for music, the late 70s into 1980. Did they think you'd be able to kind of put your ear to the ground and hear something?
Well, it was a weird time for music because I'll tell you, everything that I liked, nobody else did. It was like I still like songs. You know, I still write songs. I got like a verse, chorus, pre-chorus, and then bridge, and you know, and that kind of stuff. And it was. I remember like them sending you know punk rock and stuff. And I'm going, you know, one day people will just start talking on record.
Hey, you.
And sure enough, I was right. And actually, I produced probably the first rap song with, what's his name? Gabe Kaplan, comedy guy.
Yeah.
He called Up Your Nose with a Rubber Hose.
That's one of your works right there. Wow.
Well, I helped produce it, yeah.
I'm going to have to dig a copy of that.
Up Your Nose with a Rubber Hose. And, basically it's a track with that he talks over.
Right, yeah. I don't remember that.
With a chorus, you know. It gets to the chorus, and it's Up Your Nose with a Rubber Hose.
So you still got the studio in your house or in the shed behind?
It's a garage. I got a garage.
And all that time, were you renting out the studio? Were you doing sessions?
No. I was working. I was going out to this, the Elektra studio. I did rent my studio after my time at Elektra was over.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I supported myself up until now. Now I'm like, now I'm just biding time, hoping that when I get this record done, that there'll be some money in it for me so that I don't have to die.
Somewhere along the line, you had two wives and three kids. Is that right?
Yeah, I did that. That was one of those. That was one of those things I was doing while I wasn't writing songs.
There you go. It wasn't just all TV.
I was getting married and doing that stuff and having kids and trying to be a dad. And,
I mean, how'd that go with your mind?
Well, I was whored. I guess I was whored at it because they hate me now. But I think it was really their mothers that that took them away and just kept them. And absence makes the heart grow fonder. That's not true.
That's really your kids don't.
My father was a tyrant. He used to beat me, and he ran the house as if he were God. So you don't come into this world with a book on how to be a good parent. Not that I didn't try, and not that I'm not better than my father because I don't beat my kids, but nonetheless, divorce sucks.
Yeah.
It really does, and especially when you have children. You know, if you don't have children, who cares? But when you have children and then, my wife sort of took off and hid my children from me, my first wife, and then when I realized I could find them, it was, what do I do then? They don't like me, and they haven't called me. They don't want to be with me.
How old are they?
What do I do? I'm not good with rejection.
How old are they now?
Oh, they're grown people.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're all. I'm like really old, with the gray beard and gray hair.
Well, it's one thing. It's interesting to talk to you. Your voice is so deep, and your singing voice is so high.
Not anymore. No. Now I'm like Barry White. Oh, it's just everything is it's all really low.
Yeah. So did you?
Oh, my voice is deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
if you say
get
so.
Into radio. Let me remind everybody.
Well, let's do it. Is it a good job?
Does it pay?
No.
In that case, who wants to do it?
Yeah.
You do.
Well, I'm like you, Emmett. I love music. So.
There you go. Yeah. It's like, is it an addiction? Yeah, probably.
You're probably right. I want to remind folks we're speaking to Emmett Rhodes and myspace.com/TheEmmettRhodesBand or www.emmettrhodesmusic.net is the place to find lots of information about Emmett. There's a new documentary someone's making about you called The One Man Beatles.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you're it seems like you're an unlikely movie star.
Well, yeah.
But
you're right.
Is it finished? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have.
And what is the...
It's in Italian.
Oh, it's in...
Yeah, everything I say is in English because I don't know Italian.
Oh, so the narration is in
Italian?
But I
do change my entire accent. Everything goes up at the end.
You're like Chico Marx.
There you go.
Okay. Well, are we going to get to see that soon?
I have no idea.
Did you get money for that?
Well, I got to pay my credit card off.
Well, that's something.
Yeah.
So,
of course, it's charge you right back up again.
What do you spend money on? What's on your credit card?
Well, let me see. Food, the lights, the gas.
So the past 20 years or so, I mean, how big of a struggle has it been for you to just...
It's a horrid struggle. You know, now I'm living on borrowed time, so it doesn't matter much now.
Because
I got one of those phony baloney loans at the end of the year. They throw you in the street.
Because of your diabetes, because of...
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, depression, diabetes, all of the above. I'll wake up in the morning with like a low number, and I can just kind of like sit there for hours and wonder if I should cross the room or not.
Huh.
It's a weird thing being diabetic. It's like you're a zombie.
Yeah. So let's talk about this new project.
Yeah, let's not talk about diabetes because I wind up on the floor, paralyzed. Can't swallow, so I have to, urinate all over myself. It's a horrid thing.
It sounds like
I keep like cookies at the foot of the bed.
Just to keep your blood sugar up.
Well, in case I wind up on the floor in the morning, I got as soon as I can articulate my my arms and grab the cookies, I can eat something and come back alive again.
Emmett, is it because you don't medicate yourself properly, or?
Well, yeah, it's kind of a if you don't, if you take your shot and then you don't eat, you pass out. Sometimes, sometimes I'm not hungry.
Maybe you need to write on your hand with a Sharpie, eat a cookie or something.
Well, there you go. Now, no matter where I go, I carry sugar with me.
Yeah. Why now? I mean, how did you finally decide? You know, because I remember reading 10 years ago, you were in the middle of making a record and it was going to be done any day now. And So how do I know it's for real this time?
Oh, well, because I'm actually recording things.
So, and
I'm finalizing stuff.
And how far along are you in the process?
Well, I've got three tunes recorded.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that's how far along I am.
That's pretty good. And how do they sound? I mean, are we going to, is it just...
Well, right now, there's just basically me and the piano, and we're doing drums. We're working with Joe and Matt Malley from Plan Bass.
You're talking about Joe Larson, who was in the Merry-Go-Round.
Right.
And the bass player...
Matt Malley is the bass player of... Counting Crows.
Counting Crows. And a couple of guitar players, Dan and Jim.
Right.
And is the idea I'm going to make a record and then go
I just
up?
Didn't want to be alone.
Yeah, it's a different style for you than doing everything.
Okay, I'm like, I'm going to do some of... I'm going to sit down and play the drum. I'm going to do some where I play everything.
Oh, good.
And then I'm going to, like, I'm going to, use other people and...
Well,
hopefully have fun doing this. That's the whole idea.
It sounds like...
And come up with something that people like to listen to.
It sounds like we're not going to be surprised and it's going to be synthesizers and, Lynn drums. It's going to sound like Emmett Rhodes.
Everything's real, digital nowadays, but, I know the diminished chord. Do you play an instrument?
Yeah, I can play I got a drum set in my basement. I'm mostly a guitar player.
Yeah, there you go. You're a bass player?
Mostly a guitar player.
Guitar player. Yeah. Mostly guitar. Okay, well, then diminished chords.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I play diminished chords in a much different... I play the guitar much differently than anybody else.
I don't tune it differently. I mean, I tune it normal, and then I kind of play, not complete bar chords, but and then I know all the diminished chords in between every chord, and I pretty much got that Pythagorean down.
Do you have a guitar handy? Can you illustrate this for us?
Well, yeah, but I don't know if you're going to be able to hear it.
Yeah, try me.
Anyway, there's the guitar. Anyway, the diminished chords. I'm going to show you how I play the diminished chords. Hang on a second. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Did you hear the guitar?
It sounds perfect.
Oh. Well, I don't know about perfect, but... diminished chord. Another diminished chord. Anyway, I'm playing diminished chords like at the lower, on the lower string.
Interesting. So we've got...
And it's like, it's a real interesting chord. And then I kind of... Yeah, I'm out of tune now. But anyway, it's got a lot of diminished chords in it. In fact, these songs, they have a lot of chords in them. I made sure that I got just about every chord you can think of all in the same song.
It seems like you just unlocked what the secret ingredient perhaps is.
Yeah, I got the secret ingredient. I'm going to write it all down for people because I figure I got a lot to show them, to talk to them about.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a page long.
And so tell me about when you're writing a song, do you pick up the guitar? Do you go to the piano? Which is it?
Well, it's whichever I'm playing.
And so you just start strumming and then making a melody and making up words on top of that? Or?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that when this record's finished, you'll go on the road and play
shows?
Well,
that would be the idea. I got to make some money. Otherwise, like I say, I got no other alternative. I have to die.
I certainly think that's where the money will be. More, record sales will be secondary.
No, I'm not really. I'm like old, and I don't travel well, so I'm going to have to...
Don't you think that if you played a mixture of your new songs and a few old songs that you could...
That's the idea,
you could fill a few rooms across the country and around the world?
I was hoping. I was hoping that would be something I could do, but I'm really counting like I can't the stuff that I three songs I've recorded are all piano things, and so I don't have a piano handy or I'd play that for you, but they're good. They're really good. They're like I think they're really good.
Yeah, I can't.
I'm like showing off, you know.
You're excited. Well, it's nice to hear you excited about something.
Well, I wouldn't complete them if I weren't. That's kind of, but it's, I'm old and it's time for me to make a record. I have all these things that I haven't completed. It's time for me to start completing things.
Yeah, well, I hope, hurry up is the only advice from your...
Well, that's not, that's good advice.
But hang up on me and go...
No, I'm not going to hang up on you, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. So,
I got to do it before my phony baloney loan comes due.
There you go. When is the... what's the realistic date that we'll get to hear it?
Oh, I'm thinking, at the rate that I'm doing, I got to get my studio working so I can start recording out here, because I record on the weekends with friends out in Simi Valley. But, I'm thinking, this time next year.
All right.
Maybe sooner, probably not.
It's been a long road for you, and the way that you've dealt with it is kind of mind-boggling.
I'm a depressed person, just in general. I don't know how what you're getting to, but I'll tell you right off the bat that I'm so disappointed.
Disappointed in the world, or?
Yeah, disappointed in the world and myself and the rest of the world. Just disappointed. I like cosmology. I know what E equals MC squared means. Do you?
No.
See, there you go. Now, see, I think that's important. I think E equals MC squared is important. And it's like something that everybody should know what it means. Do you know why the sun shines?
It's a giant ball of burning gas.
E equals MC squared.
Let's pick a song from your first record to play. What's your favorite song off there? How about that?
I don't know. I don't remember. You want to give me a list?
No, it's okay.
Yeah, you know, I don't. I'm like so much in the present time that I don't really think back. That I listen to that stuff. It's kind of foreign to me now.
Really, but so many people are so attached to that music.
Hopefully, they'll like what I'm doing now better.
Through all of this, I mean, is this a life filled with regrets, or did you do the best you could? And is
Well, I have some regrets, but you wind up doing. I do the best I can, and even when I'm fucking up, I'm still trying to do the best I can.
Yeah,
or at least I'm doing the best I know. You know, and then you get old and you figure out better.
Right.
I'm a much smarter person now than I was when I was a 20-year-old. I think football's gay. Well, I think wrestling's definitely gay. I mean, you get two guys together and they're like grabbing themselves, you know, each other where they shouldn't be grabbing.
It's but this
I don't even like, you know, I don't know. Do you wear earrings?
No.
Okay, good. Well, I was about to say something about men wearing earrings. I was like wondering, what does a man think when he wakes up in the morning and he's putting his earring on?
Well, this is the 20th gay reference in this interview.
Well,
I was watching this guy on TV.
I was watching the news this morning, and there was this guy, and he's like made a lot of noise because he got to kiss some, you know, his piano player or something in the middle of his show. And it isn't as the music's important. The fact that he's gay is important.
Hmm. But you're not anti-gay, are you?
Well, not really. I'm anti-pedophile. I think Michael Jackson would be alive today if he were in jail where he belonged.
He wouldn't be on drugs and he would eat regularly. Yeah,
you're damn right.
Yeah, I mean, but being a pedophile is not.
This was a gay pedophile. Okay, there's been a few gay pedophiles in my life experience. So, what can I tell you? No, it's not. I don't want to be there. I'm glad I'm not there. Like being me. Michael Jackson wanted to be dead. He didn't want to be alive. He didn't want to be awake anymore. He wanted to be asleep.
Emmett, are you trying to say, though, that experience with gay pedophiles is personal experience is something that has colored your life?
Well, let me see. Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, I feel bad about the fact that when I was in the palace guard, the other 14-year-old was being molested, and I didn't say anything.
Hmm.
I feel bad about that, because his life didn't work out so good, you know?
Yeah.
Me, I just, like, looked the other way, and I guess everybody else did, too. And I'm wondering, you know, I was a little boy. I was only 14. What was his brother's thinking?
Jesus. Welcome to showbiz. Yeah, that's
when I who are these people? When I think back, I just wonder, who are these people, you know?
Maybe you should have just been a scientist.
Well, that's it. Those things are so much, you know, physics. You, it's so much easier to deal with. E equals MC squared. There's like, you know.
What do you like? What is good? What makes you happy? What's purely good? Anything?
Well, I like order. I like, Pythagoreans. I like music. What's good? Living things are better than dead things. That would be my first axiom. And then I'd go from there.
Okay. On that note, I guess we'll play something from your first album. Emmett Rhodes, thanks.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, what?
Yeah, I'm like talking to you. You know, I could be, you could be interviewing me, and I could be saying something about music, and I'm kind of like going off on tangents here. I apologize.
Well, I want to interview you, you know. And that's,
well, I'm like a weird
that's
dude.
That's what I got.
I'm a weird dude.
Well, I love
I think the speed of light's important.
Emmett, is any of this going to help you write a good pop song? Is this going to help you write a good pop song?
You're goddamn right it does.
All right.
I'll tell you something. I like order. I like the fun. I want to know how things are constructed, how they're put together. That's important. That helps me. When I read my physics book, and when I hit my guitar string, it was a revelation. Here's my guitar string. I was pulling the molecular bonds before I let it go. You know, I mean, the whole experience was, it was important.
I got a question for you. Did you ever, when you were a kid, did you take apart old radios?
I took apart everything.
That's funny. That is like one of the, I think that is like a tag. That trait of taking apart old radios is something super geniuses do.
Oh, okay. Well, it was everything that had anything to do. You know what? I know what a capacitor does.
Yeah, but
I know what a resistor does. I know what a transistor is, and a diode, and a rectifier, and all that shit.
It's certainly possible to make good music without knowing any of that.
Well, you know, no.
Beethoven,
sure it is.
Beethoven
sure
didn't
is.
Know that.
Mozart did it.
Yeah.
But he knew Pythagorean theorem, boy. And he knew music theory. And it's like people are making music these days that has nothing to do with that. It's just being popular. You know,
it's a different
the Black Eyed Peas. You know, I don't know any of the Black Eyed Peas. It's only the girl that I pay any attention to. I don't know the other. There's three of them. I know that. You know, but I could care less who they are. And I don't even know if I know any of their material or not. You know, I just like looking. I just want to impregnate that girl, whatever her name is.
Well, I'll try to arrange it if I can.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, there you. It's like, what is music to most people? It isn't what it is to me. Music is like a to most people. It's just entertainment.
Yeah, but that sounds like a surprise to you. I mean, isn't your experience of the world prepared you for the fact that what you think is not what most people are going to think about every single subject?
Yeah, it sure has. It's like the people I'm like a fan, but, you know, Leo Lazard, Enrico Fermi, Albert Einstein.
All right, Emmett Rhodes, this has been a fantastic interview, and
all right,
thanks, Emmett.
All righty, but
bye-bye. Down with my face on